Welcome. Hello. So we continue reading through the synthesis of yoga. We have been for some months in the yoga of integral knowledge. We're open chapter 14, the passive and the active Brahman. An unrevised chapter in the series, originally released in the Arya on the 15th of January in 1917. In the midst of World War I, and the essay right behind this was in the essays on the Gita series, Man and the Battle of Life. Here, he continues the theme that he was exploring in the last chapter, difficulties of the mental being. How can we reconcile? How can we integrate? How can we transcend and yet comprehend all possible poises which conscious being can take? Can't do it with the mind. Can we evolve a greater instrument of consciousness? Can we bring that greater instrument of consciousness down into us? It is all the play of the yoga. So here we deal with the poises familiar to us in Sankhyan philosophy, Purusha watching Prakriti, the generality of what is real being as approached and defined and described by the various schools of Vedanta. But Sri Aurobindo has something within him which is akin to Sri Ramakrishna, which is to contain both sides of reality. That which is dynamic, that which is static, in unified being. And to make that manifest here. To bring it into mental, emotional, vital, physical reality, that this omnipresent divine must be experienced in every part of our being for the yoga to be complete, to say that we have something like fulfillment, like siddhi. So let's begin reading. Chapter 14, The Passive and the Active Brahman. The difficulty which the mental being experiences in arriving at an integral realization of true being and world being may be met by following one or other of two different lines of his self-development. He may evolve himself from plane to plane of his own being and embrace on each successively his oneness with the world and with Satchit Ananda, realized as the Purusha and Prakriti, conscious soul and nature soul of that plane, taking into himself the action of the lower grades of being as he ascends. He may, that is to say, work out by a sort of inclusive process of self-enlargement and transformation, the evolution of the material into the divine or spiritual man. This seems to have been the method of the most ancient sages, of which we get some glimpse in the Rig Veda and some of the Upanishads. He notes here, notably, the Taittiriya Upanishad. He is referring to the third chapter of it there, the Bhrigu Valley, where the father Varuna enjoins Bhrigu through the power of tapas, through forceful effort to discover what is real, what is finally real. And the boy discovers that matter is the basis of all things, and then discovers that that is not all sufficient, that life is the basis of all things, but that too is insufficient, that there is a greater plenary world of mind, and that too is insufficient, that there is a vast consciousness of great knowledge, of limitless truth, and that too is not sufficient, because queen of them all, regnant over all these various planes of existence, is Ananda. It is because of delight that we have the great consciousness and mental acuity and vital power and a form in which to move upon earth, seeking delight, always founded in delight, sourced in it, and endlessly rediscovering it as we move through the cosmos. So, that is the Taittiriya Upanishad. He continues, he may, on the other hand, aim straight at the realization of pure self-existence on the highest plane of mental being, and from that secure basis, realize spiritually, under the conditions of his mentality, the process by which the self-existent becomes all existences. But without that descent into the self-divided egoistic consciousness, which is a circumstance of evolution in the ignorance. So this is the Isha Upanishad, the eighth verse. Who, Swayambhu, who has auspiciously distributed objects through sempiternity according to his will. So everything has been beautifully arranged by this divine being. And the Isha says, you too are a universe in motion in this moving universe. You too have been sparked into being by this Isha, this great Lord of all. So you can get to this experience, he's saying, of self-experience, self-existence, Swayambhu. Know what yourself is through the highest reaches of the mind and not fall back from that into the division of egoistic consciousness. Thus identified with Satchit Ananda in the universal self-existence as the spiritualized mental being, he may then ascend beyond to the supramental plane of the pure spiritual existence. It is the latter method, the stages of which we may now attempt to trace for the seeker by the path of knowledge. When the sadhaka has followed the discipline of withdrawal from the various identifications of the self with the ego, the mind, the life, the body, he has arrived at realization by knowledge of a pure, still, self-aware existence, one, undivided, peaceful, inactive, undisturbed by the action of the world. The only relation that this self seems to have with the world is that of a disinterested witness, not at all involved in or affected or even touched by any of its activities. If this state of consciousness is pushed farther, one becomes aware of a self even more remote from world existence. All that is in the world is, in a sense, in that self, and yet, at the same time, extraneous to its consciousness, non-existent in its existence, existing only in a sort of unreal mind, a dream, therefore, an illusion. This aloof and transcendent real existence may be realized as an utter self of one's own being, or the very idea of a self and of one's own being may be swallowed up in it, so that it is only for the mind an unknowable that, unknowable to the mental consciousness, and without any possible kind of actual connection or commerce with world existence. It can even be realized by the mental being as a nihil, non-existence or void, shunya, but a void of all that is in the world, a non-existence of all that is in the world, and yet the only reality. To proceed farther towards that transcendence by concentration of one's own being upon it, is to lose mental existence and world existence altogether and cast oneself into the unknowable. As a drop dissolves into the ocean, as a pillar of salt disappears into the sea. So this is certainly an age-old path which leads to dissolution of attachment to the world and its difficulties, leads to the dissolution of the ego, the recognition only of that being, if being it is. Sri Aurobindo now continues, the integral yoga of knowledge demands instead a divine return upon world existence, and its first step must be to realize the self as the all, sarvam brahma. This goes back to the most ancient of the Upanishads, the Brihadaranyaka, section 1, the 4th chapter, the 10th verse, where it describes that this Brahman becomes all. First, concentrating on the self-existent, Swayambhu, we have to realize all of which the mind and senses are aware as a figure of things existing in this pure self that we now are to our own consciousness. This vision of the pure self translates itself to the mind sense and the mind perception as an infinite reality in which all exists merely as name and form, not precisely unreal, not a hallucination or a dream, but still only a creation of the consciousness, perceptual and subtly sensible rather than substantial. In this poise of the consciousness, all seems to be, if not a dream, yet very much like a representation or puppet show taking place in the calm, motionless, peaceful, indifferent self. This, of course, describes his first liberating realization in 1908 in Baroda in January, when he left the apparent self and merged his conscious being in that great self, or that non-self. He annihilated the ego in plunging into this reality, which made all cosmic movement, each action in the world, seem evanescent, meaningless. And yet, almost after taking one breath, he rejoins the work to liberate India from the British. Poised in this consciousness in which he was not, in which India was not, yet he continued to work. Let's go on. Our own phenomenal existence is part of this conceptual movement, a mechanical form of mind and body among other forms. Ourselves, a name of being among other names, automatically mobile in this self with its all-encompassing, still self-awareness. The active consciousness of the world is not present in this state to our realization because thought has been stilled in us, and therefore our own consciousness is perfectly still and inactive. Whatever we do seems to be purely mechanical, not attended with any conscious origination by our active will and knowledge. Or if a thought occurs, that also happens mechanically like the rest, like the movement of our body, moved by the unseen springs of nature, as in the plant and element, and not by any active will of our self-existence. For this self is the immobile, and does not originate or take part in the action which it allows. This self is the all in the sense only of being the infinite one who is immutably and contains all names and forms. So, Dikshara Purusha, the moving, unstable personality with this mood and that mood, this sharpness of intelligence, this dullness, is dissolved into the Akshara, which is a white sea of motionless, still, silent consciousness. Or is there consciousness? Is it just static being? Can there be awareness when there is no object to apprehend? This is the problem to the mind. To the spirit, this is no problem at all. The basis of this status of consciousness is the mind's exclusive realization of pure self-existence, in which consciousness is at rest, inactive, widely concentrated in pure self-awareness of being, not active and originative of any kind of becoming. Its aspect of knowledge is at rest in the awareness of undifferentiated identity. Its aspect of force and will is at rest in the awareness of unmodifiable immutability. And yet, it is aware of names and forms. It is aware of movement. But this movement does not seem to proceed from the self, but to go on by some inherent power of its own and only to be reflected in the self. This is the Purusha watching Prakriti. In other words, the mental being is put away from himself by exclusive concentration the dynamic aspect of consciousness, has taken refuge in the static and built a wall of non-communication between the two. Between the passive and the active Brahman, a gulf has been created, and they stand on either side of it, the one visible to the other, but with no contact, no touch of sympathy, no sense of unity between them. Let's pause and remember Sri Ramakrishna in this context, who was to Sri Aurobindo profoundly important, because he saw in Sri Ramakrishna that he did not stop at the borders of the mind. His realization was something more than truth seen through the dividing mind, what we would call the spiritual mind, but that he had a power to lift himself into higher ranges of awareness and could see intuitively, could see more vastly. Sri Ramakrishna, if you read his gospel, says more than 36 times that Brahman and Shakti are the same. They are the same reality. The active poise of the divine is the same as that which seems to be silent and unmoving. It is the same reality. Enter into the experience and then enter into the other experience. For Sri Ramakrishna was like Sri Aurobindo, indefatigable in his pursuit of truth. Sri Ramakrishna had this wonderful image that religions and sadhanas, we can say, are like ladders, and God is like the roof of a house. Use any ladder you like, but get to the roof of the house. But for Sri Ramakrishna, it wasn't simply a matter of going up one ladder and sitting there. He could use any ladder and climb, gain access, and then come back and speak about it and inspire others and lead the world forward through spiritual achievement. That was his way to achieve loka sangraha, the holding together of the worlds, to show that the static, the immobile, and the active, the dynamic, the dance of Shakti, are the same thing. So climb every ladder. Find your way up, but then find your way back. Bring it back here and enrich the earth. Sri Aurobindo would take this idea of the Ishvara Koti and the Jiva Koti to farther realms with his integral philosophy. But he looked back on Sri Ramakrishna and said, that's the thing. Let's start this paragraph over again. The basis of this status of consciousness is the mind's exclusive realization of pure self-existence, in which consciousness is at rest, inactive, widely concentrated in pure self-awareness of being, not active and originative of any kind of becoming. Its aspect of knowledge is at rest in the awareness of undifferentiated identity. Its aspect of force and will is at rest in the awareness of unmodifiable immutability. And yet, it is aware of names and forms. It is aware of movement. But this movement does not seem to proceed from the self, but to go on by some inherent power of its own and only to be reflected in the self. In other words, the mental being is put away from himself by exclusive concentration. The dynamic aspect of consciousness has taken refuge in the static and built a wall of non-communication between the two. Between the passive and the active Brahman, a gulf has been created, and they stand on either side of it, the one visible to the other, but with no contact, no touch of sympathy, no sense of unity between them. Therefore, to the passive self, all conscious being seems to be passive in its nature. All activity seems to be non-conscious in itself and mechanical, jada, in its movement. The realization of this status is the basis of the ancient Sankhya philosophy, which taught that the Purusha, or conscious soul, is a passive, inactive, immutable entity. Prakriti, or the nature soul, including even the mind and the understanding, active, mutable, mechanical, but reflected in the Purusha, which identifies itself with what is reflected in it and lends to it its own light of consciousness. When the Purusha learns not to identify himself, then Prakriti begins to fall away from its impulsive movement and returns towards equilibrium and rest. The Vedantic view of the same status led to the philosophy of the inactive self or Brahman as the one reality, and of all the rest as name and form imposed on it by a false activity of mental illusion, which has to be removed by right knowledge of the immutable self and refusal of the imposition, footnote, adhyaropa, which means imposition. You'll remember the image that Shankara used of the mistake, the fundamental mistake we make. We're walking in the dark and we see a rope and we're suddenly seized with alarm and fear because we don't see the rope. We see instead a cobra, a snake. There is no snake there. It is a rope, and we have imposed a creation of our own mind upon it. So there is this layering between what the mind looks at and the thing seen. And that thing that's in the middle we call knowledge, based upon our perceptions and our valuations, etc. It is an imposition. The rope hasn't done anything to cause you fear, but you feel the fear because you have interpreted it. You have wrongly seen, gathered a false bit of data with imperfect senses, constructed a reality, and reacted all in a flash. Now you have fear. So, Sri Aurobindo continues, the two views really differ only in their language and their viewpoint. Substantially, they are the same intellectual generalization from the same spiritual experience. That is, of the integrity of the witness and the unreality or the non-soul reality of the thing seen. It is that which lies at the basis of the Purusha experience, rejecting Prakriti, and is that which lies at the basis of the Vedantic experience. I accept true, pure being, and all movement of the cosmos is false. It's the same thing. The mind has made a judgment. The experience of what is immortal and real is one thing. But the philosophic judgment that follows is another. If we rest here, there are only two possible attitudes towards the world. Either we must remain as mere inactive witnesses of the world play, or act in it mechanically without any participation of the conscious self, and by the mere play of the organs of sense and motor action. Another footnote, Kevalayer Indrayer, from the Gita. That's chapter 5, verse 11. In English, therefore, the yogins do works with the body, mind, understanding, or even merely with the organs of action, abandoning attachment for self-purification. In the former choice, what we do is to approach as completely as possible to the inactivity of the passive and silent Brahman. We have stilled our mind and silenced the activity of the thought and the disturbances of the heart. We have arrived at an entire inner peace and indifference. We attempt now to still the mechanical action of the life and body, to reduce it to the most meager minimum possible so that it may eventually cease entirely and forever. This, the final aim of the ascetic yoga which refuses life, is evidently not our aim. By the alternative choice, we can have an activity perfect enough in outward appearance, along with an entire inner passivity, peace, mental silence, indifference, and cessation of the emotions, absence of choice in the will. This is opposite of what we should reflect upon on the 24th, on Siddhi Day. We'll put a bookmark there and come back to this next week and finish our chapter. I thought that we should read something that's in accord with the first part of this chapter for tonight. So let's look in Savitri at Book 7, the Book of Yoga, Canto 6, Nirvana and the All-Negating Absolute. And we can begin on page 545. Whoops. In that absolute stillness, bare and formidable, there was glimpsed an all-negating void supreme that claimed its mystic Nile's sovereign right to cancel nature and deny the soul. Even the nude sense of self grew pale and thin. Impersonal, signless, featureless, void of forms, a blank, pure consciousness had replaced the mind. Her spirit seemed the substance of a name, the world a pictured symbol drawn on self, a dream of images, a dream of sounds, built up the semblance of a universe, or lent to spirit the appearance of a world. This was self-seeing. In that intolerant hush, no notion and no concept could take shape. There was no sense to frame the figure of things. A sheer self-sight was there. No thought arose. Emotion slept deep down in the still heart, or lay buried in a cemetery of peace. All feelings seemed quiescent, calm, or dead, as if the heartstrings rent could work no more, and joy and grief could never rise again. The heart beat on with an unconscious rhythm, but no response came from it, and no cry. Vain was the provocation of events. Nothing within answered an outside touch. No nerve was stirred and no reaction rose. yet still her body saw and moved and spoke. It understood without the aid of thought. It said whatever needed to be said. It did whatever needed to be done. There was no person there behind the act, no mind that chose or passed the fitting word. All wrought like an unerring apt machine. As if continuing old habitual turns, and pushed by an old unexhausted force, the engine did the work for which it was made. Her consciousness looked on and took no part. All it upheld in nothing had a share. There was no strong initiator will. An incoherence crossing a firm void slipped into an order of related chance. A pure perception was the only power that stood behind her action and her sight. If that retired, all objects would be extinct. Her private universe would cease to be. The house she had built with bricks of thought and sense in the beginning after the birth of space. This seeing was identical with the seen. It knew without knowledge all that could be known. It saw impartially the world go by, but in the same supine, unmoving glance, saw too its abysmal unreality. It watched the figure of the cosmic game, but the thought and inner life in forms seemed dead, abolished by her own collapse of thought. A hollow physical shell persisted still. All seemed a brilliant shadow of itself, a cosmic film of scenes and images. The enduring mass and outline of the hills was a design sketched on a silent mind and held to a tremulous false solidity by constant beats of visionary sight. The forest with its emerald multitudes, clothed with its show of hues, vague, empty space. A painting's colors hiding a surface void that flickered upon dissolution's edge. The blue heavens, an illusion of the eyes, roofed in the mind's illusion of a world. Far enough for one evening. Namaste. Jai Ma.